From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we bring you the fourth in a series of discussions with Professor Luciana Bone, detailing the history of revolutionary Russia and the early years of the Soviet Union, and drawing lessons from those learned at that time for events happening today. Our previous conversations began with a discussion of the period known as war communism, which began in June of 1918 and ran until March of 1921, when the New Economic Policy, or NEP, was adopted, that in turn lasted until 1928. War communism included the nationalization of all industries and the introduction of central management, state control of foreign trade, and particularly troublesome for the relations between workers in the cities and peasants in the countryside, the requisition of agricultural surplus from peasants to be distributed among the remaining population. Those policies were amended with the adoption of the New Economic Policy, which allowed private property rights for peasants and other changes. Okay, Luciana, so we said we would pick up in NEP and then the things that followed from there. So let's start with, we're wrapping up and sort of summarizing NEP.
Right. We stopped last week. Well, we were analyzing Lenin's defense of his position in instituting the new economic policy. So I'm just going to summarize briefly where we ended. And So he said that the whole question with the restoration of private property in the new economic plan is, what will happen? Which forces will take the lead? Who will come out on top, he said. So, he said, either the capitalists succeed in organizing first, in which case they will drive out the communists, and that will be the end of it. Or the proletarian state power, with the support of the peasantry, will prove capable of keeping a proper rein on those gentlemen, the capitalists, that's his word, so as to direct capitalism along state channels and to create a capitalism that will be subordinate to the state and serve the state. In other words, not for profit, but to build the power of the proletariat and peasant state.
Right.
So he said those are the questions. Now, evaluation of NEP. On the positive side, I would argue that it held the social base of the revolution together. The social base of the revolution was the proletariat, which was small, and the peasants.
And there's also a geographic correlation there. I mean, you have the proletariat, concentrated in the cities, and then the peasantry in the countryside. And so this way, if you're going to have a nation state with borders, you had support throughout the geography of the nation state.
Yeah, that's right. Because in the previous programs we went through what happened to the, shall we call it, the social base. Remember, Lenin mentioned that the proletariat was practically inactive. Factories were destroyed. There was no industrial activity. And the peasantry constituted 80% of the population, while the proletariat was practically only a statistic. As a result of the Civil War, the destruction of the factories, and, the decimation of all this. So, on the positive side, by reintroducing private property, in other words, the restoration of capitalism is really a big word, but it was really reintroducing private property, the NEP conciliated the peasantry. Now, the peasantry, I know from my own experience, you know, from my own family experience, the socialism coming to Yugoslavia, I mean, the idea of actually having the land taken away,
right.
Try taking away the land from a peasant.
Right.
So, by reintroducing private property, then the NEP quieted the peasantry, for whom ownership of land is a sort of existential identity.
Right.
So, and it was the largest group with an interest in private enterprise. They had joined the revolution, the peasantry, because they had wanted to end feudalism. Serfs had been abolished, but and the end of big landowners. So that's why they wanted the land, and it was redistributed.
Just
so
let me
they had joined the revolution wanted to end feudalism and the oppression of the landowners.
And the land was one of the actual demands and promises of the revolution. It was peace.
Absolutely.
And land and bread. And this just for people here to understand what you know at that point where. Feudalism had formally ended, you know, where serfdom, was outlawed. It was analogous to the end of, the formal end of slavery in the United States, but the economic relations continued. The peasants still lived on the landlord's land, and they still lived more or less at the will of the landlord, in the same way that the people who were owned by the plantation owner before now had their labor owned by the plantation owner, and very little else changed in their condition, and that was what prevailed. And suddenly, the revolution promised land, and so that's why it was very difficult and antagonistic, in fact, to try to take the land away from the peasants who had just gained it.
Yeah, that was a real huge threat to the revolution with that. So, you know, when you have a population of 80% to 90%, then you have to consider what policies will alienate them and which will conciliate them. Sounds like a compromise, but get them on your side. You know, they were the human material that will make up the new growing working class. And if you consider that by the 1970s, the peasantry had shrunk to 20% of the population, then you sort of realize that actually the industrial base of the Soviet Union was really, really grew out of the conciliation of the peasants.
That's right.
So in effect, you know, the working class was constructed on this base. I think Lenin knew very early that the peasants were crucial and kept in touch with them. So, but the negative side is this. NEP also gave rise to petty entrepreneurs in the second economy. These were the hated NEP men. Now, they shrank rapidly with collectivization under Stalin. This class of new men, new rich men, but it reemerged under Khrushchev, under his so-called liberalization, and then increased enormously under Brezhnev, and actually came to power under Gorbachev.
Right.
So I'm sweeping through here, but I'm trying to point out how relevant studying NEP is, to what happened and to what is happening. So that's the general conclusion at that time. Now, so then Lenin dies in 1924. And what happened after he died? So since the social unit, not necessarily unity, but unit had been secured, the question then became, what road do we take to socialism within the party? You know, the discussion became, so now where do we go? Do we continue NEP? Do we do something else? Now, the party eventually gave consent to what became known as socialism in one country. But this result was the result of at least 3 years of debate from 1924, 25, 26, 27, 3 years of debate among the three leaders that remained of the Lenin, after Lenin. And that was, they were Trotsky, Bukharin, and Stalin. Now, all three were convinced communists. However, so we called Trotsky group the left, and the Bukharin group the right, but we're not to confuse that with anything in the West, okay? Anyway, Trotsky proposed domestic development of industry, collectivization and mechanization of agriculture, economic planning, and the fourth specific theory. He stressed the need for international revolution as the only hope for Russia to avoid bureaucratic degeneration of the party, which he saw coming, and loss of revolutionary fervor. Now, his left opposition proposals were defeated in 1925 by the 14th Party Congress. They endorsed rapid industrialization and self-sufficiency, but not the international revolution. Now, I don't want to go now into what is the international revolution, what is permanent revolution, you know, all the debates,
right,
that are the politics, the philosophy of Trotsky. It's important to just know that, you know, the first three of his proposal, domestic development, collectivization, and economic planning, did not disturb, as we will see, what eventually happened,
right,
what eventually was accepted. But the fourth, need for international revolution, did split the party seriously.
Right, that was a point of divergence. There was unity, more or less, on those other issues, but on the point of either socialism constructed inside the Soviet Union or having to wait for international conditions to ripen, that was the point of divergence.
Oh, very well put, thank you. Yes, exactly. Okay, so then Nikolai Bukharin's proposal were considered next in 1927. Trotsky's were defeated in 1925. Nikolai Bukharin was an editor of Pravda, and he was the intellectual explainer of the party's agenda, sort of. And he was an official of the Cominform. He wrote the ABCs of communism. So anyway, Nikolai Bukharin believed that Russia could not skip the stage of capitalism or even pass through it quickly. And there again, we have... So what does he, where does this belief go? It goes back to Marx, Marx and Engels, who did not say that socialism was impossible in one country, in a capitalist country, in one capitalist country. But they were talking about a developed capitalist country anyway. So Marx said, yes, socialism in one country was possible, but they were talking about capitalist country, you know, developed countries.
Right.
So, so Bukharin took that point by Marx and stuck to it. He believed that Russia could not skip the stage of developing capitalism. Right. So he proposed, his proposal resembled those of Western social democracy, really, in the end. He had been very left, and by 1920 or so, he became more right, which is reflected in his proposal. He was softening the idea of class struggle to a peaceful contest between competing interest groups, between state industry and private industry, between private farms and cooperative farms. And he, whereas Lenin saw the NEP as a retreat from revolutionary principles, Bukharin saw it as a road to socialism. He wanted to continue NEP. He opposed rapid industrialization. He opposed the collectivization of agriculture and any coercion of the peasant. So his proposals were rejected by the 15th Party Congress, which adopted the policy of promoting collectivization of agriculture.
Right, and this is now like late 1927, yeah. We're talking.
1927.
Yeah.
So now you see what's happening in 1925, Trotsky's proposal for continuing, for waiting for the international, for socialism to be international, and Bukharin's opposition, and Bukharin's desire to continue NEP has exercised, shall we say, the party. There are two dissatisfied groups, the left and the right.
Right. The left is waiting for revolution, essentially, in Germany and France and elsewhere to make the international condition favor the development of socialism in the advanced countries in particular. The right is saying, in essence, let the private sector develop inside the Soviet Union, and this will help us have the material means to reach socialism at some point in the future. Those are the two forces that are pulling, and you have Stalin essentially pushing for, and this is the third, and this is what's characterized as a center, but saying, in essence, collectivized agriculture, rapid industrial development, that's the and socialism in one country, and that was the path that got followed. And by the way, probably it's a good thing that that's the path that was followed, because it might have been impossible to defeat Germany absent that rapid industrialization.
Yep. I mean, but all the Bolsheviks had believed that the world was ripe for revolution in 1917-18, Lenin included. But they realized once the German socialists failed to rise up, all the other revolutions in Europe were crushed,
right,
or failed to rise up,
right,
by 1921. Look, in Italy, fascism came to power in 1922.
Right.
So only Trotsky was arguing that there was still a possibility. Do you see?
Yeah, I do. And also looking across the Great Lake to the United States, the same thing. You had perhaps not as strong a possibility as in Europe of socialism, but very strong workers' movements, and they were crushed,
yeah,
absolutely crushed, with the World War I and in the aftermath of World War I.
That's right. So you're right. You summarized it very well, what resulted from this debate. Now I'm going to go to Stalin's proposal, which through these debates, you know, Stalin came up with his own solution for the way forward to socialism. And as you mentioned, that was socialism in one country. He argued that the Soviet Union could advance towards socialism without a revolution in the West and without passing through developed capitalism, provided that the country, so that was his point number one, we can develop socialism in our own country. And two, provided we industrialize rapidly. And three, industrialization required financing. Where was it going to come from? So he argued that the growth of industry would have to be financed by increasing agricultural production. Mm. Yeah. And this required large collective mechanized farms. And finally, the fourth point was central planning to coordinate industrial growth with agricultural production. Now, the British historian H.E. Carr, whom I'm reading, said that this was political genius, that Stalin made a second revolution and that he continued and fulfilled Lenin's revolution. That's what he says. So that's the conclusion for the time being of the story of the new economic plan.
All right. So then what follows?
Well, what follows is that, you know, what's behind this socialism in one country idea is really the menace of rising, especially that will be evident in 1930, the threat of Germans, of an invasion. I mean, Lenin had said to Stalin after the Civil War, we have gained a little time, but they will be coming for us.
Right.
And so that was always present, you know, throughout the 20s, that not only did we have to develop socialism, but that we were constantly under attack and that somehow we had to build a strong defense industry. And it was, you know, in the event, it was Germany that came for the Soviet Union. But so in 10 years, between 1930 and 1939, you know, Stalin built, industrialized the country. There were tremendous, tremendous sacrifices and accusations. But yeah, the collectivization of agriculture did make the state solvent ever after. There wasn't a, you know, sort of deficit in the future. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to go into details in 8 minutes because I want to pick it up next time.
Yes, we can do that.
Or what actually the details were. But right. Do you think it was possible in any other way for Russia to survive the Nazi attack, for the Soviet Union to survive the Nazi attack without this sort of push?
Yeah, I mean, let's take a look at the conditions that existed at the time of the revolution, you know, in terms of geopolitics and geopolitical power relations, and then at the time of Operation Barbarossa, or let's say VE Day in 1945. You had the Russian state was completely devastated and exhausted at the end of World War One. In fact, that was what gave rise to the success of the revolution at that point in time. The old system completely failed, and the country with it, as a consequence of its involvement in the war. And the country itself, as you mentioned, there was no proletariat, essentially. There was an unemployed, small unemployed proletariat, because the country had not been intensively industrialized, nothing on the scale of Germany or France or the UK, for example. There were feudal relations in the countryside. At the point that Germany invades, you had an entirely different condition, where in 4 years, the Soviet Union pushed Germany back to Berlin and occupied Germany. So there was a huge change in the material base what became the Soviet Union in the period from 1921 until 1941, 20
years. We're talking about 1927, more or less. The Congress accepts the social, in rapid industrialization, and they started implementing it in 1930. So in 10 years.
Right. Really. Yep.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. From the
ground up. It's amazing what they did in 10 years. You know, the 20s, they sort of saved the revolution. It was from invasion and from internal problems. And then in the next 10 years, they prepared to repel the imperialist attack that they knew was coming. And the Germans were tremendously surprised when they saw the kind of weapons the Soviets had developed in terms of tanks. I have to go over notes and stuff like that, but they were astonished. They were also astonished that they underestimated their military forces, and it was admitted by the generals, their military equipment, shall we say. They had underestimated that terribly. There are historians who argue that the Nazis were actually stopped by December 1941-42, December, January, in the Moscow battle by repelling, the Nazi had come 30 miles within distance, of Moscow,
right.
And they were repelled back hundreds of miles.
Mm-hmm.
So this was just an amazing sort of, it's just unbelievable what Stalin did, what the Soviet Union did under the leadership of Stalin.
And by the end of Stalin's time, by the way, he died in 1953, we're talking 3 short years later, the Soviet Union again astonished the world, out of the ashes of World War II. Suddenly they were the first in outer space. They launched Sputnik.
Mm-hmm. And, 3 years earlier, developed, or four, when was it? The nuclear bomb.
Hydrogen bomb, that's it, yep.
Yep. Hydrogen bomb.
Yeah.
If they hadn't done that...
There would have been a whole different history. I think we'll pick it up there. We'll go back next week and pick up, do some detail about what happened during the 1930s into that. And then following that, I'm looking forward to the part when we get to start tying this into some of the things that are going on right now, because folks should understand the reason that we're going into this, what seems like ancient history, is there are some very valuable lessons for what's happening right now nested within. So thank you very much, Luciana.
Yeah. Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
The same. Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.